Welcome to The Living Revolution, where we explore the evolving field of synthetic biology. We're your hosts, Sandra Martinez and Zara Knurowska, in conversation with scientists, engineers, and entrepreneurs who are harnessing the power of biology to tackle some of the world's most pressing challenges.
We're here with Team Captain Johannes and Treasurer Nico from the Wageningen 2023 iGEM team. Join us to discover how they implement traceability in their design, how they combine biobricks to create novelty in science, and the responses from the farmers in their outreach thus far. Let's begin. What do you think is the most important problem facing the 21st century?
We from the iGEM team 2023 in Wageningen think it's climate crisis. And as we are studying in the Agriculture University of the Netherlands, we thought about how climate crisis is affecting farmers. So we went to them and asked them how they are affected by global warming. And what we discovered was honestly quite surprising. Warm weather periods in spring lead to early flowering in many fruit trees, including cherries or apples, peaches, almonds, lots of them. However, late spring frost still occurs. And because of the early flowering time of the fruit trees, flowers are nowadays even more susceptible than ever to frost damage. We asked 11 cherry farmers in the Netherlands and all said that their harvest is suffering from frost damage. Current methods of frost damage prevention includes igniting fire pits between the fruit trees to warm up the air with the warm smoke and spraying water on the flowers. The water is then forming a protective layer around the flowers, diminishing the frost damage more or less. We asked the farmers if they are satisfied with the current solutions, and they clearly stated that the current prevention methods are highly labor intensive and very expensive. What can we as biologists do to help the farmers? Here's what we thought. The problem is the flowers are blooming too early, what then makes them susceptible to frost damage. Let's make them bloom later again, and the problem is solved. So far, so easy. But how do we do that? And that's what our project is then about. Flowering time is controlled by phytohormones, including peptide-based hormones. By increasing the concentration of anti-flowering hormones now in the developing bud, we can delay flowering up to a moment when no frost damage is to be expected anymore. Now, I'm not so good with plants, to be honest, but I like bacteria very much. And one thing many fruit species have in common is that their rhizosphere, the area around the roots, is colonized by bacteria. And one of these bacteria that is colonizing the roots is the bacterium Pseudomonas fluorescens. A very unique feature of this bacterium is its capabilities to secrete proteins from the bacterial cytoplasm via the so-called type 3 secretion system into plant cells. And that's where we can complete the picture more or less. We genetically engineer P. fluorescens in a way that it produces an anti-flowering protein. This anti-flowering protein will be then secreted via the type 3 secretion system into the plant. Trail up the phloem to the bud. The phloem is, by the way, a kind of transport system of the plant, and travels up the phloem to the bud to control flowering time. Of course, there's much more to it, and we have thought about many other things, but for now, let's keep it here.
Do current EU or other regulations make something like this possible?
So to give you a short answer, no. Current regulations do not allow for the use of our GMO in the wild. But Europe is also known for being more restrictive with the use of GMOs compared to the rest of the world. For example, in agriculture here in Europe, there is, I believe, one type of corn, of genetically modified corn, that's being used overseas in the US for many crops like soy, corn, or cotton. More than half of plants that are being cultivated are genetically modified. So we're dealing already with a landscape that's more restrictive, but that doesn't mean that we don't see our product being used or that it won't be used in the future. We are, for example, pretty well aware of some of the requirements here in Europe to get a genetically modified organism approved. There's three main points, those being risk assessment, then proper labeling of the product that is involved or that we use our genetically modified organism for. And also, since we're putting organisms with modified DNA in the wild, they have to be traceable.
Maybe first things first, also yeah. With the whole EU regulations and so on, at the moment, we are still in a state of making all the lab work, and we are far away from having a product which then could be approved by EU regulations. But we thought, of course, about EU regulations and terms of risk assessment and labeling and traceability.
Could you tell us more about perhaps some of the risks the EU might see within a product such as the one that you would be proposing?
We have to think about the risks concerning the interaction of our genetically modified bacteria in the soil with other bacteria that are also living there. And then we have to think about potential side effects of inserting a final phytohormone into the plant. We discussed this throughoutly, and we think first, in terms of interaction with other bacteria, we are using a bacterium that is natively living in the rhizosphere and is a so-called plant growth promoting bacterium. With this in the back of our heads, we think that the bacterium should integrate into the colonies and into the community of bacteria that is already living in the soil. And then when we think about the hormones that we want to introduce into the plant, here we have the great benefit that we are changing our bacterium in a way that it produces a plant hormone that is produced by the plant itself as well. We're just supporting the plant in a way that it can produce or get access to even more of these plant phytohormones. We critically question the impact of this manipulation, of course, yes. But then again, let's think about humans. We also sometimes take hormones in a hormone therapy to fight certain diseases or even to control a pregnancy with the contraceptive pill. Again, you are taking hormones from the outside, for example, in the pill, but for the better, for cure health or for control the pregnancy. And in a certain way, that's also what we are doing here with our bacteria, that we are giving them hormone to control its flowering, so its sex organs development. And that's a kind of contraceptive pill for the plant, if you may say so.
Have you been introduced to the concept of IP, and how much support did your team get with this topic?
Regarding the concept of IP, we have been introduced to it. All of us have a general overview of what IP is to begin with, how patents work, and how they fit within iGEM. We're doing, of course, now research with, well, BioBricks. If any of you have done iGEM or are familiar with it, BioBricks are pieces of DNA that can be assembled to make functions, like kind of words in a sentence. These BioBricks that we are developing and researching, they are made public. It's public domain. Other teams can use it in the future. We're not only researching BioBricks and characterizing them, we're also developing an organism which is able to do something very complex, which is secreting this antiflorogen into tree roots. Within iGEM, many of these projects have the potential to become companies. We've been introduced to these ideas, and we know that we have to be a bit careful in some aspects, but also since iGEM, again, is this international competition, we really value the open source aspect of it. Since we're also we're using pieces from teams in the past. So, I mean, it's definitely something beneficial.
Our project has these two phases. What are the elements of intellectual property? So on the one hand, we have the BioBrick research we conduct and the results we discover in the lab. And as a part of iGEM, and that's what also Nico mentioned so clearly when he talked about the open source information, within iGEM, all the knowledge we gain is shared with the world. And that's for the better. And that's also something we are at the moment using in terms of we are also using the knowledge of previous iGEM teams to conduct our research. And then on a second step, and that's the other part, we are making this bacterium that controls flowering. And that's where it gets interesting. But maybe after iGEM, when we think about what could we do with this product, what could we do with the bacterium, thus this whole idea has the potential to turn into a company. Once we are less thinking of knowledge gaining and more thinking about the economical side, then IP would be very interesting to really make something out of our product and make it big in the world.
We think IP is definitely important, but like Johannes said, it's crucial more after iGEM. So it's good to keep it in the back of your mind when you start with a project like this, but it shouldn't be the main focus. The classic example of Ginkgo Bioworks, which back in 2006 also started as an iGEM project. And well, thanks to intellectual property, they have grown into this massive company. But it's, yeah, Ginkgo isn't the only example. I think you guys, even on the show a couple episodes back, you had a company that also started as an iGEM project to detect, I think it was heavy metals in water.
Yeah.
It's definitely something that is important within like SynBio projects, and people should take into account.
What type of intellectual property you'd be looking for, like, or to gain after the competition is over?
We're using many things that have already been characterized. So we cannot claim intellectual property on those, and it's in theory nothing new. Well, there are some biobricks that are new that we are integrating in our project. But I think the novelty of our project is the combination of these tools into one organism, and especially doing it in Pseudomonas fluorescens, which is our chassis, is something that has not been done before. There is where intellectual property comes into play. When combining all these different tools that already exist into a chassis that's not conventional. And I think in the end, what we would like to have protected would be like this function that our organism has, not a specific DNA, you know, a sensor or a promoter, but more the whole product itself.
When I'm thinking about the future of our project and making a patent out of it, then first thing, like by definition, to make a patent on something, the something, the product has to be innovative and industrially applicable. I think about the innovation part, we don't even have to talk about it, because what Nico already said is that it is a very innovative and new approach that we are taking here to prevent frost damage. Now, with the industrially applicable part, that's more complicated. Then we have to think about the upscaling of our solution to make it really big and to make it, put it into a context of industrial applications.
You're working with the Pseudomonas fluorescens, right? It is not really a conventional chassis per se in the iGEM competition. Expand more on what are some challenges that come with working with like unconventional chassis.
It's a great journey to not work with a model organism. Mm-hmm. And I think what many iGEM teams and also many researchers in general do is that they kind of sit back and use the benefits of model organisms in terms of, you know, what to do. You have protocols for it, for genetic engineering and so on and so on. But for many real applications, and then again, we are talking about, for example, industrial applications, a model organism is not, yeah, is kind of the low hanging fruit, but not the best one in this regard. Sometimes using a non-model organism that is more easily applied to the real world is the better choice. For example, now in our project, we are using a bacterium that is natively living in the roots rhizosphere, in the plant's rhizosphere. And we are using a non-pathogenic organism. And that was very important to us. Now, for example, there are other organisms, other Pseudomonas species that are genetically more accessible, but then they wouldn't survive, for example, in the rhizosphere. And then we had a nice proof of concept and maybe some nice genetic engineering. But in the end, all the genetics inside a bacterium that could never be released into the real world.
I wanted to add also some things about the difficulties of using a non-organism strain in the lab. A bit of a guideline or some of the things that we've learned is the most important thing is the organism has to be sequenced. If you put foreign or new DNA into an organism, you have to know what DNA there is already there or what functions there are. And luckily now it's much easier to sequence a whole genome compared to how it was many years ago. So that is less of a hurdle. That's just the first step. Then something as simple as transformations, which in E. coli is literally just putting a tube at 42 degrees for a bunch of seconds, might not work in something that's unconventional like our strain. So we've had to figure out many of these protocols, which for E. coli or Pseudomonas putida, you can just find online. We've had to develop these ourselves. And it doesn't stop there. Also, genetic parts, when you put them into a non-model organism, it's harder to predict than for conventional strains, since no one has done it before. So you don't know if the reason why some of your experiments are not working is because the part that you put in is wrong, or because it's not compatible with the organism that you're using. And I mean, these are some of the challenges that we faced up to now. And yeah, who knows what comes in the future, but I'm sure that we're not the only team in iGEM that is dealing with these issues. But we, yeah, of course, we think, to, like Johannes said, to have a real impact and for your product to be applicable, you have to choose an organism which suits the application. So that's why we chose for this bacterium. It's a bit harder to engineer, but in the end, it's what works in the soil.
Yeah. And with every challenge, and that's the beauty of the story, it's even nicer if it succeeds in the end. If you don't have a protocol how to engineer the bacterium, and you have to make this protocol yourself, and in the end it works, then you really think like, damn, I really made something. And that's also great.
What would you say then are some of the key challenges in scaling your proposed solution?
We think that in order for our project to be successful, the first thing that has to be done, and this should be done in science always, is reaching out to the public, to the stakeholders, to see if the solution that you're thinking about is it really worth it to begin with, or is it practical? And of course, it's a bit hard to predict how your end product is going to look, but involving the public and the users and everyone involved from the beginning should be the first step. And we've been doing that by talking to farmers and the public and of course experts. So that's the first part. So having like a need for what you're developing. I would say the next challenge up ahead is developing everything in the lab. So project like ours, we're putting all these different functions into a bacteria. And we have to test these individually first in the lab to see what works and what doesn't, or how things work. So then kind of jumping in the lab, that would be the second like biggest challenge when scaling up. Once you have tested things individually, you know what works and what doesn't, you have to put it together. And that sounds very simple, but it's an enormous challenge. It can take years, and then that's kind of what makes or breaks many of these projects, because individual parts work, but when you put it together, how do these parts interact with each other? And is it even feasible to put them all in an organism?
When I can add something to that point, we have different students working on different projects, and one is working on the production of our phytohormone inside the bacteria, and one is working on the secretion, and one is working on the kill switches that makes it then sensitive to ensure biocontainment of the thing. But then in the end, when we put all together, it's a balance act, because on the one hand, we made a bacterium that is sensitive to root exudates, to attachment, to chrome sensing. We made all the things to make our bacterium safe and that it cannot escape to other roots and to other plants. But still, we need a bacterium that is strong enough to compete with all the bacteria that are living right now in the soil. And that's the balance act. We need a strong bacterium that is highly sensitive to all the things to make it safe and strong in the same way, at the same moment.
Like Johannes said, once you put everything together, it's time to test it. Once you've completed this balancing act. And right now we're doing it like on a pretty small scale with like model plants, which are not fruit trees. But mm-hmm. Then I guess the next step would be to test our GMO mm-hmm. in, of course, a contained environment with fruit trees to see if it does eventually what we want it to. And this takes many, many years down the line, and of course, a lot of approval.
Expanding from that, in the end, would you see the product being used, let's say, within irrigation systems?
Our bacteria is something that we plan to put in the soil. Since it's a bacteria that's native to the soil, it should, well, it already like grows in it. It also is able to maintain itself with the substrates that are normally found in there. But we also want it to be safe, of course, right? We're putting a GMO in the wild. We don't want it to spread. So like you mentioned, we want to use the irrigation system not to feed bacteria into the soil, but to add to the soil chemical molecules that keep our bacteria contained to the orchards in which farmers want them to be. In theory, the inoculation of the soil should be a one-step process that is done only one time. And then throughout irrigation, we're able to keep them there. And also with irrigation, we would be able to remove our bacteria from the soil by adding a different molecule, which in this case tells our bacteria that it has to die. And that way it's removed from the soil when farmers are like, okay, we don't want to block flowering anymore.
In terms of application of our product, so the application of our bacteria, and it's very important to us that is that we can apply it in a way that takes no extra effort for the farmer to apply it. So we want to integrate it somehow into the farmer's workflow. And as we are already talking about it, this could be done with many, many things. We could apply it with the water or together with fertilizers or with some other working procedures the farmers take.
I want to come back briefly to what you mentioned at the beginning in terms of thinking about the possibility of this being real. And specifically on the topic of traceability, you mentioned how making this potential solution traceable would be very important. What methods have you considered to make something traceable, trackable, so that people can easily know if it's in the soil, how much of it is in the soil? How do you plan to track that?
Indeed, traceability is very important because we want to know where our GMO is and what it does at the moment. Normally, GMOs are traced via DNA detection. You take a specific part of the DNA of this GMO, make a PCR, and then you can see whether it is in the sample or not. It is like the COVID test we all did. You make a PCR with the DNA of the virus, and then you can see whether you have COVID or not. Now, we wanted to take the extra mile and make the traceability even more simple. So therefore, one of our team members is working on a so-called DNA barcode. Okay. With this DNA barcode, you can easily detect whether our bacterium is still in the soil or not. Like in a real barcode, you use the barcode and a scanner. The scanner can easily be applied to scan whether our bacterium is still in the soil sample or not. Maybe even by the farmer himself or herself. Okay. When she wants to check if our bacterium is still in the soil, she just scans the soil for this barcode, and then she has the certainty.
In this case, what is the scanner and what is the barcode?
So this barcode that Johannes is talking about is a DNA fingerprint that we're putting into the genome of our organism. So we mentioned that we're using this strain that's natural to the soil. In order to distinguish it from the actual strain that is natural to the soil, we're adding a few DNA segments which are not present in the natural strain. So by looking for those fragments, we can tell if our organism is there. And we're, of course, making sure that this DNA that we're adding, that it's not found in nature, so that we don't by accident detect the wrong strain as ours. The scanner in this case is, well, DNA detection is, it's more widespread now than it was many years ago. Metagenomics can be used, and we're using like a method that allows for on-site DNA detection, not in a lab, because then of course it's not practical, right? If the farmer has to go to the lab every time he wants to check, then it's not a practical solution.
Do you still sort of collect a sample and decide that this sample is a representative of the soil?
It's good that you bring that up. We are not planning, of course, with one small soil sample to determine the state of the whole orchard. That's, of course, a lot of statistical work involved in that. A few of our team members are currently working on figuring that out, how many samples can we like give a good overview of the state of the orchard. And so it would be many different samples from different parts of the orchard. And with that and our easy method of detection, on-site method of detection, the farmers that use our products should be able to determine whether our bacterium is in their soil or not.
So is this like AC method of detection one of your bio breaks for the competition?
I think you can call it like that, even though the functionality of our barcode is pretty limited in terms of we use it to detect our bacterium, and most of the other barcodes are then used for general applications.
Could other teams use it in the future?
Definitely, and that has been already done. The usage of DNA barcodes is a quite common and upcoming method of detection of bacteria.
Yeah, it's also the main purpose of it is detection, like Johannes is mentioning. But it could also be used for biosafety. If you want to remove then only our like modified strain from the soil, what sets it apart at a genetic level from a natural strain is this barcode. So it can also act like a target for many biosafety features.
The whole discussion about the efficiency and how would everything work and what the bacteria would in the end really do in interaction with other bacteria, that are all the things we can hypothesize on, but of course in the end, to find the real numbers for that, that's not as easy right now to say. We can make all the thoughts about scaling up our solution and so on and so on, but in the end, the borders also, again, the general acceptance of this kind of product and the legal affairs concerning GMOs in Europe.
It's also important to mention, in terms of synbio in farming in general, there's a huge discussion to be had about what crops we even grow and how we do farming. Moving, let's say, for example, would the system in which this solution could work is only one in which monocultures were still a thing that we are going to do within farming for the rest of time? Or would this solution also be compatible with new methods of, like, for example, agroforestry, for example? I mean, it's a separate discussion to have.
Yeah, that is true. That's all the question about how we apply it in the end and how it would work for the farmers and with their workflow and so on. I think when we're talking about the future of our project and about our product, we can think of the best ideas how to make it safe and how to make it work efficiently. But in the end, it's also the general acceptance and the legal affair concerning GMOs in Europe that plays a pivotal role. On the one hand, strict legislation is in principle a good thing and a valuable thing. It ensures that we handle new technologies of genetic engineering with responsibility and caution. Sometimes I also think that there are some so-called glass ceilings that need to be broken to allow advancement and innovation in the agricultural sector. In this term, I can just motivate everyone to inform themselves about GMOs. And I think after that, we will definitely be able to enter into a discussion that is not guided so much by fears and stereotypes, but more by reasonable arguments. And especially the part of getting information is not so easy always. For example, I requested to distribute the farmer service among the farmers in Switzerland and to just get feedback on what they think about our solutions and to inform them of our project. And this morning, I got the answer that the man that I was in contact with from a big agricultural association in Switzerland, they won't deliver the whole information sheet about our project to the farmers with the explanation that they do not accept GMOs anyway in the Netherlands. And it's nonsense to distribute such unrealizable ideas about GMOs that controls flowering among farmers, because this information is of no use for them. That's at least what they thought. But I think they are wrong. I think GMOs are not the solution to all the problems, but it's one tool that we have to think about. And the information about GMOs should be spread to inform everyone.
If you enjoyed this episode, give us a rating, a like, share with your friends, and follow for more.